Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog, now offering free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM6.
And by Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. Hear Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore investigate the world of on-demand movies. It's no longer available through the Film Spotting feed, so subscribe now in iTunes or grab the RSS feed at filmspottingsvu.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. We're halfway through 2012, so to help us count down our top five films of the year so far and discuss Steven Soderbergh's new film about male strippers, please welcome to the microphone, all the way from Kenosha, Wisconsin, a small town boy looking for love in the big city, the Chicago Tribune's Magic Michael Phillips.
Thank you. And I'm actually wearing my breakaway critics outfit tonight.
Nice. Wow. And exciting.
When that reporter's notebook goes flying, something's going
to
happen.
I've been waiting for you to bust that out.
Save that for Massacre Theater, which we will be playing later. But first, squeal all you want. Just remember, no touching allowed as we discuss Magic Mike.
The businesses that I manage, they deal exclusively in cash.
Wow, busy guy.
We welcome to stage the one, the only.
Magic Mike.
You are the husband that they never had. You are that dreamboat guy that never came along.
Schizopolis is the name of one of Steven Soderbergh's directorial efforts, but it could also be a good description for his career. You never know what identity his next movie will have. So it wasn't really a surprise when he announced he would be making a film about male strippers starring Channing Tatum, who was a male stripper before finding fame in Hollywood. Despite a supporting part in Soderbergh's other 2012 movie, Haywire, Tatum isn't the sort of actor normally associated with top-tier directors, despite the faith many critics, myself included, have in his talents. So what we have here is a male stripper movie by an Oscar-winning director featuring the star of G.I. Joe. All of this leads me to wonder, Michael, is this a Steven Soderbergh film, whatever that means, or a Channing Tatum one? And did you appreciate it more as one over the other?
I'm less keen on Channing Tatum as an actor, I think, than many, although it's a testament to Soderbergh's facility with actors, I think, that Channing Tatum's giving what is easily his most relaxed, his loosest, and his kind of just his most engaging performance in Magic Mike. And it's a film, it's certainly one of the most entertaining films Soderbergh's made in a couple of decades. And he's made, even the films I don't like of his, I like, you know, in a way, because he, as you mentioned, he's experimenting all the time, certainly with subject matter. Not really so much with visual approach, because there's an interesting consistency to his work, I think. And what you get, I guess the surprise with Magic Mike for me is you have this sort of trademark deadpan remove with Soderbergh's approach to the story, in that I think a different director, even with this same script, could have turned the whole thing into this heavy breathing, almost more of a comic melodrama, amping up the every cliche that's floating around under the surface of this script about, you know, the kind of the experienced 30-ish male stripper who's a construction worker by day and a, you know, an exotic dancer by night, played by Channing Tatum, and he brings on the new kid.
He's got big dreams.
And he's actually big dreams. God knows. Tampa's big city, you know, big dreams. big state, Florida, you know, room for dreams down there. And the new guy who's actually called the kid, you know, played by Alex Pettifer, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And already you're talking about stuff that sounds like, you know, it's ripe for a midnight parody, you know, on the vein of Showgirls or something. But Soderbergh's, you know, got a great, easy touch with all of it. And, I think it's a close call in that it is a Channing Tatum project, right? He produced it, you know, his production company kind of got this going. Soderbergh, though, clearly sees something in this guy. He used him effectively and not, you know, briefly in Haywire, a film I like, too, that went zippy with nothing,
right,
with the public.
Yeah.
Public hated that film, Haywire. And I'd be surprised, guys, if the public were similarly indifferent to this. I think it's just got kind of enough movie stuff in it to succeed.
Where are you on Tatum, Adam? Because even in Haywire, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about him. I thought he was quite good in it, but do you think he does have range? Does he show it here?
Well, I didn't love him in Haywire. He doesn't get a whole lot to do in that movie, but no, I'm one of the big Channing Tatum proponents out there. We go back to the list we did recently of our top five up-and-coming actors and actresses, and remember back in 2008 when we did that list, he had just done one movie, A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, and I thought he was so good in that film, the Dito Montiel movie, that I said, that guy's going to be a star. I really thought he was going to be great, and he was in my top five, and then as I joked recently, I started to look really bad with some of the decisions he was making, and he wasn't looking like he was going to pan out, and then he makes 21 Jump Street, which was a big surprise, a genuinely pretty funny movie. And he is so charming and so affable and so genuinely funny and just naturally self-deprecating. And he brings a lot of that to this performance as Mike. I think he's really good here.
So are you in business? Why aren't you?
I will be as soon as the banks start making the competitive rates and loans. And I will. Look, I've been saving for 6 years. I mean, why do you think I'm doing all these stupid businesses with stripping? It's just, I don't know. I've saved about 13 grand. It's going to happen eventually.
Wow, 13. That's a lot of ones.
There were some fives in there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No 20s?
You don't want to know what I have to do for 20s.
You know what? I don't.
You know what? Let's drink these and I'll show you what I do
no,
for
20s. That's no, that's okay.
It's kind of an easy role for him. I mean, he's playing a part that he already played in real life in a lot of ways. And he does have that sort of ease. There's an effortlessness to him. And I really appreciated that. I don't think this gives him the chance to show what else he can do, except maybe in the dance scenes, which is really interesting. I mean, I first caught notice of him in Step Up, of all things.
Right. Yeah. I like the Step Up.
I actually like the original Step Up, too. Yeah. And I thought, wow, this guy has talent and potential. And the dance scenes there are incredible. And they are here, too. They're interesting, especially that final one he does, where he's kind of trying to break away from the club owner played by Matthew McConaughey.
All right, all right, all right.
There you go.
He basically reprises his role.
This is where he could end up, right?
Yeah,
about
older,
20, 30 years
a
later.
More ambitious.
Owning a male stripper club. I could see that.
Yeah.
But yeah, Tatum's trying to break away from all this. And so he defies him in doing a different routine than what was scheduled. And what's in that performance is there are a lot of layers there. There is the defiance, there's kind of the anger, the self-loathing, and also just the sheer talent. And it made me think that if this guy could just get maybe a movie musical, you know, a modern movie musical to show where his range might be, because I don't think his range is where he's tried in some of these melodramas. You mentioned the bad projects that he's been in, G.I. Joe. This isn't going to really let him shine.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's likely to be engineered into a career, and probably a very lucrative career, as an action star.
Mm-hmm.
I'm less convinced than you guys are of any kind of range or, again, I say, I think Soderbergh is a smart enough director to loosen up almost everybody he's working with. And he's been working with all kinds of, you know, however you define newcomers, but he works with all kinds of newcomers. And then he'll, of course, turn around and do something like Ocean's 11, which is full of these seasoned pros, right? But when you mentioned Matthew McConaughey, that he's got the kind of devilish movie star charisma that I think Channing Tatum is only barely figuring out how to tap.
Don't worry about it. All right, rule number one, this is the what can you touch and not touch rule. Can you touch this? Can you touch it? No, 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 no. Take a touch. Can you touch it? Can you touch it? No, 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 no. Well, that too, the law says that you cannot touch. But I think I see a lot of lawbreakers up in this house.
McConaughey, as the wrangler and manager of this Exotic Male Review, is just giving the kind of star turn, you know, in a key supporting part that it's got everything for me that something like Tom Cruise's work in Rock of Ages does not have, which is, I mean, to me, that was all effort and rehearsal and humorless, sort of an approximation of having a good time.
He's making it look too hard.
Yeah, too hard.
Maybe.
And McConaughey just, you know, the great thing about Magic Mike, I think, and it's not a major movie, but I think it's majorly entertaining, is that the whole movie's got kind of a roll out of bed and let's film it quality.
It does.
And that's Soderbergh, you know, more than it is Channing Tatum. And the film is not a Channing Tatum showcase. You know, that script is pretty cleverly balanced among three or four key characters.
It's interesting, though, that you say how entertaining the film is, and I agree with you. It is certainly through the first half, maybe even the first three quarters, but I was actually surprised at how much Soderbergh and Tatum seem to be kind of defying the audience to like the movie. I think there gets to a point where maybe it falls into a little bit of a cliche. We've certainly seen this kind of storyline before with Boogie Nights, the newcomer coming in to this world of decadence and kind of being swallowed up by a little bit. That happens with the Alex Pettifer character here. And watching it, I felt like it was going to a little bit of a darker place. That by the time we got to the end of this film, and I just came from a screening of this movie that I will note was 95% women probably in the audience, and they all seemed like they were there to have a good time watching Magic
Mike.
You were
like in the strip club, essentially.
Basically, it
was ladies' night. I noticed you actually have ones and fives sticking out of your belt loops right now.
It was ladies' night, apparently, there at the screening, and they seemed like they were all pumped up to have a good time, and they were really into the film. That last 20 minutes or so was very quiet, very quiet. And by the end, I felt like people were really trying to decide kind of where they fell with this movie. And I think part of that is going back to your initial question, Josh, it's a Channing Tatum film in a lot of ways, but it's definitely a Soderbergh film. You can definitely watch this movie and see right from the opening shot, frankly, where I believe it's Olivia Munn is with Channing Tatum. They've just had a night together, clearly. Just from the opening framing of that shot, the diffused lighting, the filters that he's using there in terms of the cinematography, and of course Soderbergh shoots it. And then we get to the moment where we see Magic Mike driving down the road in his car. He's driving down Tampa and the music's playing. It feels like it's something right out of sight. So there are those elements there, including this great camera moment where I guess I can just describe it as the scene where the kid and Matthew McConaughey score with a couple of girls, and we get this crazy camera shot where, I don't know, it folds in on itself upside down and ends up on one of the guys after it started on the other. It's pretty nuts. Those are all elements that, frankly, if you knew nothing about this film and just showed someone who's seen Soderbergh's movies different snapshots, I think you'd know it was his work.
It's very stylistic visually, but I got to say, I found this to be extremely conventional in terms of the moral arc that the movie is after.
For sure.
So predictable. I mean, you mentioned melodrama, Michael, and I was really shocked at how predictable it was, in that we're going to see this kind of seedy world and the hero is going to learn there's something else and something better. And it just, maybe that's part of the letdown that you sensed. I don't know that it just went exactly where you thought it would go. And Soderbergh doesn't even really seem that interested, I guess.
No, he's
in
not.
That
no,
arc.
No. But I think Soderbergh's got kind of a way of critiquing his own material as he goes. He's a very smart director that way. And he knows how to. I didn't experience the film as a disappointing melodrama or kind of a, God knows it's full of cliches, but I think the way he kind of eases the material past the worst of the cliches, he's really focusing more on the aspects of Magic Mike that are kind of a workplace comedy. That's why I like the film. I like sort of this funky milieu that, you know, you don't see every film. And when you have this sort of wryly skeptical heterosexual director filming this kind of thing, it doesn't have the kind of headlong, nutty energy of a movie like Showgirls or Burlesque, that thing with Cher, which I think is still going on somewhere. I mean, it was felt endless to me. But Soderbergh, I think, really has that critic's sensibility that kind of takes a step back and says, you know, look, it's corny. I'm gonna find a way to make this fresh. And that's why I respect him as a filmmaker, even with movies that make me crazy. And this is not one of them. I think this is a very easy film to like.
What I think he's actually interested in here, and what makes the movie more interesting, it's not only workplace, like you said, it's really a business movie. It's a movie about business, and Tatum's character likes to think of himself as an entrepreneur. And really, everyone in this film is hustling for a buck in some way. The one figure who's not, who's trying to do it the honest way, is the kid's sister, who works a 9-to-5 job. And she and Tatum's character come together. And again, that's a relationship. You can pretty much see where it's going to go right away. But it does work against these other guys who are all trying to find the easiest, quickest way to make a buck. So there's a lot of economic desperation going on underneath this movie that I found interesting. And that sort of carried it along for me outside of the melodramatic conventions.
There is something to say about this notion of the American dream a little bit that he's playing with. He did it in the Girlfriend Experience as well. So I agree with you that the issues of economy and where the business world is at is something that factors into this film. Maybe it's just kind of window dressing to make the whole film seem a little bit deeper than what it is, which is essentially a male stripper movie. And it does have a lot of cliches. But I thought, for me, the thing that was really interesting, and Michael, you hit on it when you said how it all kind of feels like they just rolled out of bed and made this film, despite the fact that it has all those elements I touched on in terms of clearly a methodical approach in terms of the visual look of the film and some of the shot setups. Obviously, very meticulous, as Soderbergh always is. But what's interesting with these last two films is he's going in a direction that he started playing with a little bit with movies like The Girlfriend Experience and Bubble, where he was casting basically real people to play themselves on screen and improvise a lot of their dialogue. He was kind of having them play themselves and giving them setups to a scene and having them go with dialogue. And what he's doing with Haywire and this film, Magic Mike, is he's putting actors, legitimate actors, in those same kinds of situations. And what I noticed here was this sense of improvisation. I don't know how much was really done or not, but didn't it seem like there were a lot of conversations that sort of had that very natural, very much were searching for kind of the truth in this moment? And sometimes that really worked. Sometimes I felt like I love the fact that there weren't those movie kind of moments. There weren't those melodramatic kind of cliche moments, because I felt like the actors were really invested and they were trying to find the truth of a scene in their character. At the same time, you get the flip side, which is you get a very big dramatic moment, big relative to this film, near the end of the movie, where Channing Tatum's character has to give what would qualify as kind of a monologue.
This is the on the waterfront.
Yeah,
scene,
and it seems like he's just tripping all over himself.
Because he's not a good actor. Yeah, you guys are overselling Channing
Maybe
Tatum.
So.
You are. This is the thing. There are scenes where he has to essentially act a conventionally written melodramatic monologue with sort of the usual beats and builds into it. And Channing Tatum gives birth to every line. And it's just, you know, he has not yet learned how to finesse his way through something that just requires a kind of technical facility. What he's good at is everything else. He turns out to have been a pretty good knucklehead comedian in something like 21 Jump Street.
Right.
And he can bring a lot of that same more off the cuff quality to everything here, and you know, God knows there's a lot of the onstage sequences in Magic Mike are generous. I mean, that's almost at least a third of the running time.
Right.
You're back in the club, so you're getting a lot of ass chaps, is what I'm trying to say.
You are,
and everything you're saying, Adam, about kind of the way Soderbergh undercuts, or he'll just jump cut out of a big moment onto something else. My colleague at the Tribune, Chris Borelli, talked to Soderbergh the other week, and we were talking the other day. Moments like that, you can just sort of count, okay, that's another $5 million off the box office. That's another five. That's
right?
Another. And a movie about male strippers starring Channing Tatum, that's basically kind of a straightforward, cliche-ridden thing, that sounds like money. But Soderbergh is finding a way to make it more kind of questionably commercial, but
right,
a hell of a lot more interesting. So that's what I think.
Let me ask you a question. You mentioned the extensive dance sequences and how many of them are. Did either of you find it odd that this movie about male strippers that features a lot of those scenes almost had more female nudity? I'm just trying to wrap my mind around that. And you mentioned Soderbergh being a heterosexual director.
Kind of, but
I don't know if this is some sort of hypocrisy here.
I'm just trying to figure it out. There's a lot of Botox in this thing, Josh. I didn't count,
but it struck me that for a movie about male strippers, there's a lot more
a
the other way.
Of topless
I mean,
women.
Yeah,
I just
seemed a little out of place.
I'm a sensitive fellow, Josh, and I find that actually Soderbergh is not shooting this like some sort of horn dog hetero. I actually find this is a pretty evenly balanced cheesecake.
I'm not saying that
buffet, you know, and I think the other question about audience response to almost any Soderbergh film is something you talked about, Adam, about, you know, he shoots his own work, you know, under various aliases, as his own cinematographer. And he's been really in the vanguard of shooting digitally in all kinds of lighting conditions on first Red cameras. I don't know what they shot this thing with. But there's something, though, about the palette and the look of Soderbergh's digital cinematography that on some level, I think in a way that audiences haven't even really completely figured out, they kind of associate it with a somewhat cheaper or low rent or some, you know, kind of experimental indie look. But I think a lot of it's really artful and really well considered, and some of it is less so.
This movie is very gray.
It's gray, and it's sort of mustard yellow.
Mustard yellow, exactly.
This is like Florida.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Haywire was that way as well.
A lot of Haywire.
A lot of this takes place after a night of partying very early in the morning, and it has that grayish morning light to it. The one exception, really the only exception in the film, is that beach walk that Tatum's character and the kid's sister take together, and the sun is just glistening glistening off the water, reflecting on their bodies. It's like somehow Soderbergh has turned the sun into a disco ball or something. It's really a shocking scene because it stands apart from the glumness, mm-hmm. the visual glumness of the rest of it, aside, again, from those dance sequences.
Now, is that the scene where they go – it's like the picnic out on the
They're
sand.
They're on a sandbar, right.
See, it's my favorite scene in the film. Because yeah. it's like,
oh, it stands completely apart.
Yeah, and visually and for other reasons too. I love that scene because it's kind of a first date scene between Channing Tatum and his
Cody Horn.
Cody Horn.
Who I think is very good. In this film.
Have you ever seen a more I can't even really tell how much real skill she has. I think she's got considerable talent. I've never seen a more relaxed performance.
Right.
I mean, it's like it's
And I think that's where some of that
natural.
Improvisation I was touching on comes through. It really does in that scene where they're walking on the beach.
And I think Tatum's very good there.
Really
they're together.
Go.
Yeah.
There's kind of an awkwardness
yep.
to that first date encounter where she's even a little bit goofy that you wouldn't expect that character in that moment maybe to be if you were watching a bigger budget Hollywood film. Mm-hmm. And I love those kind of real touches.
I really like that
film.
Scene too because the way Soderbergh and the screenwriter too, you're just sort of eavesdropping for 2 minutes with this conversation, then kind of over here with a couple of the other strippers and their girlfriends, and then here and there. And I love the kind of panoramic, you know, and none of it forwards any kind of plot. I mean, I think to go to this movie for narrative payoffs is a huge mistake.
I would agree.
It's all about atmosphere and just sort of the vibe for the thing. And the
Magic
Butox.
Mike.
The Butox.
There yeah, you go. The it's out wide this weekend. If you agree or disagree with our takes, we hope you get a chance to see it. Let us know what you thought. Email feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Who says you have to wait until the end of the year for best of lists? It's not too early for us to name the best movies of 2012, at least so far. Massacre Theater and the Film Spotting Top 5 are next. Stay with us.
I want to hear your voice coming out of my radio. I want to see your face on the billboard sign. Because I know how hard you try. And I know sometimes it makes you cry. I just wish I could be there to bring you by. I wanna hear you talking to me from a payphone, telling me that dreams can turn real. 'Cause I've been there before, I've been knocking at the door, and I know how that burns, I know how it feels. So go on, show 'em what you're made of. With all my heart, I wish these things for you. That someday you and all you put your hand to will turn gold.
Film Spotting is presented by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace recently reduced their prices. There are great incentives right now, making it one of the best times ever to sign up for a new account.
We've promoted Squarespace quite a bit on the show. It's a really fantastic service. They've simplified their subscription plans. The reduced pricing you mentioned, Josh, they're offering standard plans as low as $8 a month. They've got hundreds of design templates to choose from that you can customize. iPhone, iPad, and Android apps for updating your blog or site on the go. And they've got online resources and a special support team to give you personal help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can't beat that. And one of our Film Spotting listeners, Scott Pfeiffer, also a Film Spotting student at the University of Chicago's Graham School, though Josh, Scott didn't sign up this semester, and I'm trying not to hold it against him.
Yeah, that's got to hurt, huh?
It does. It hurts, really. I'm sure he has something better to do with his summer, though. He says, I'd long thought of setting up a site but didn't know where to begin. Squarespace's tutorials walk me through it, and their helpful, responsive support staff is also there to answer any questions. I've been using Squarespace for a year now. It's everything I could have wanted in an outlet for expressing myself. Scott's site is dreamsandvisions.squarespace.com if you want to see what Scott has done with Squarespace.
You can use Squarespace for all of your website needs. Build it, host it, update it anytime. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com. You can sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out and start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase it, use offer code FILM6 and get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. And don't forget about free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions. That's squarespace.com and use offer code FILM6.
My mother, father, and I are all borrowers. We borrow things that Beans won't miss if they're gone. Just little things, soap and cookies and sugar, all things that we need to survive. Even my great-grandfather was a borrower.
I think my grandfather saw one of you once.
It's possible.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Our special guest, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, is with us. And you just heard a scene from the Disney release of a very good Japanese animated film co-written by the legendary animator Hayao Miyazaki, The Secret World of Airy Eddie. If you look on Metacritic or you look on RottenTomatoes.com or listen to the show when we discussed Airy Eddie, it's one of the most acclaimed films of the year. We'll find out if it's good enough to make one of our top five lists as we get to our top five films of 2012 so far a bit later in this segment. But first, it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a screenplay and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
Why do you want to join a force?
Protect the property and suzerainty.
Oh, please, don't waste my time with that bull. Where are you from, Stone?
From the south side.
Stone. George Stone. That's your name? What's your real name?
That is my real name.
Nah. What was it before you changed it?
Giuseppe Petri.
Jeez, I knew it. That's all you need. One thieving wop on the team.
What's that you said?
I said that you're a lying member of a no-good race.
It's much better than you stinking Irish pig.
Oh, I like him.
That's Sean Connery as Jim Malone and Andy Garcia as George Stone, or Josh, what's his real name?
Giuseppe Petri.
What was that?
Giuseppe Petri. Is that better?
I almost regret that I set you up for that. Of course, Andy Garcia as Giuseppe Petri in 1987's The Untouchables, or as Dan in Milford, Connecticut put it, that would be The Untouchables, at least, I think, show. Referencing my great performance as Sean Connery last
Enough
week.
About my accent. What were you doing? Was that Irish, Scottish, or Connery-ish?
That was my Scottish.
You actually sounded like Al Pacino in Revolution.
Probably.
There we go.
Probably. Of course, The Untouchables was directed by Brian De Palma, written by David Mamet.
Kristen Roth from San Rafael, California, she had the accents figured out. She says, although Sean Connery might play a stinking Irish pig, he is actually Scottish, as is the whole gang from Brave. Patricia Clarkson also appears in The Untouchables, and she is a beautiful redhead, tying in with your top five list last week.
We did talk about Pixar's Brave, and that's where we were going in terms of the Scottish tie-in with The Untouchables. And Sean Connery didn't think about Patricia Clarkson in The Untouchables, but it's been quite a while since I've seen that whole film. So good connection there from Kristen. But we also got this note from Matt in New York, New York. He says, it would be pretty tough to massacre that scene as it was performed by two rather limited actors. And he's not referring to us here, Josh.
Oh, I hope not.
Really, how much of Sean Connery's praise is deserved? Those old Bond movies are unwatchable. And so much of his work is characterized by him playing his Sean Connery persona, playing that character. The man never brought an ounce of nuance to any role.
Whoa, slow down, pal.
Wow.
Matt better hope he never runs in to Sean Connery.
Can you fire somebody from being
being a listener?
From a podcast listener?
Yeah. It's been revoked.
We try not to do that.
No. We'll take all the listeners we can get, Michael. But do you want to disagree with Matt?
That comment does not deserve it. Well, that's an interesting point of view. No, it does not deserve that. No,
I don't hear what you're saying. You are just completely wrong.
I think Connery's a, oh my God, he turned into such a good actor. Especially once he got out of the Bond franchise, mm-hmm. But I think the best three or four Bond movies are, you know, hold up well, even if you're past the arrested adolescent phase. And name me a better Bond, man. Come on.
I can't. George Lazenby?
Roger Moore?
Daniel Craig, maybe.
Roger Moore, boy. I talk about a guy who just always made you root for somebody like Louis Jordan or Jeffrey Holder,
Well, a lot of people did correctly identify The Untouchables. I'm sure it's because of my dead-on Connery impression. Josh, reach into the brimming Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Our winner is Brian Knapp from Portland, Oregon.
Congratulations, Brian. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your prize.
Because after Salome, take another picture and another picture. You see, this is my life. It always will be. There's nothing else. Just us. The camera.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/Film Spotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
And this week's winner will get a complimentary 6-month subscription to Fandor. I don't know what we can say about this scene other than there is a connection to, there's a connection to Magic Mike. We've got a main character here who has a little bit of a heart of gold and has big dreams that he or she is trying to make come true. And this is also a Massacre Theater first. We've never had someone portray an animal before, but it's going to happen.
We have the right person.
We have the right person for it. Someone with more talent, more range than Channing Tatum. It's Michael Phillips. Are you ready for this, Michael?
I'm not anymore. You've overfluffed this one, I think, Adam.
All right. I'm going to start it off. Josh, you're going to give me the action.
And action.
What's his name?
Grunt.
Grunt?
Yeah.
I can see that I don't have to worry about you. What was he before he became a dog?
Well, he gets upset when people he doesn't know follow me home. Come on, Grunt. This is the man that feeds you.
I'll tell you what. Tell him I'll bring him a doggy bag if you'll have dinner with me.
I told you I don't think it's a good idea to go out with the boss.
Okay, have it your way. You're fired. I'll pick you up tomorrow at 8.
And scene.
Michael, well done.
Thank you.
What breed was that?
Done.
You're
a method actor.
Or would that give it away? Do we want to keep that secret?
It's more like a cat playing a dog. I don't know.
Wow.
I was going for something kind of complicated.
Just layers
like, just,
there.
Just like the way I kind of sabotage the 5 lessons from the movies, you know? You know how I sabotage that with an overcomplicated sort of...
I loved your theme. Yeah. I loved what you went for on our 400th show, Michael. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, July 3rd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Are you a bad little baby?
No, you're not
a bad little baby, no. You seem like the baddest little baby in the whole world.
I'm not a baby.
You're mad at me, baby?
Yes, I felt mad at you.
I love you, baby.
Wait, okay, don't do the baby thing. Don't kiss me or something. Just not both together.
That's a scene from the new Sarah Polley-directed film Take This Waltz. It's been playing on demand for 3 or 4 weeks, but it is opening here in Chicago and select cities around the country this weekend. Sarah Polley, probably better known to a lot of people as the actress from The Sweet Hereafter in her younger days and Dawn of the Dead. She was also recently in the movie Splice, but she made a great film Away From Her a few years ago with Gordon Pinsett and Julie Christie. And here she is with her second film, Take This Waltz. Michelle Williams and Seth Rogen, the stars of this film that deals with a love triangle set in Canada. So everyone's really polite and really sweet. And we're going to talk about it a little bit in our Film Spotting bonus content. So if you go to the website and go to our apps page, or you go to the Amazon store for Android, or go to iTunes and do a search for the Film Spotting app, you can get the bonus content we bring to you every week. So we'll share a few of our thoughts on the new Sarah Polley film, Take This Waltz, there. Also want to quickly plug an upcoming event. Our friend Robert K. Elder, who wrote the book, The Film That Changed My Life, 30 directors on their epiphanies in the dark. He got 30 different filmmakers to pick the movie that, as the title says, changed their life, the movie that had the biggest impact on them. And he has these long-form interviews, and he's been having these recent events at the Music Box. We've promoted him. We've actually played some of the interviews here on Film Spotting, and a good one is coming up Saturday, July 7th, Raising Arizona with director Jay Duplass. So you heard Mark Duplass last week on the show as we talked about.
We needed to vary up a little bit and talk a little bit about Jay, huh?
And Jay Duplass picked Raising Arizona, which is one of my all-time favorite comedies. So if you're in town, unfortunately I won't be. I can't go to this event, but if you're around Saturday, July 7th at the Music Box, they're going to screen the new Duplass Brothers film, the Dodeca Pentathlon, and have a Q&A, and then do the Raising Arizona Q&A after that. So sounds like a great time. We'll link to more information and ticket info about that event at the Music Box in the show notes at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, you can participate in our weekly poll questions. We'll get to our results from last week here in a moment. But we were thinking about the unfortunate passing away this week of Nora Ephron, the writer-director, probably better known as a writer. Many credits to her name, including Heartburn and Silkwood, and of course, When Harry Met Sally, and Julie and Julia, and Sleepless in Seattle. And so we thought this was an interesting question. Rather than just maybe picking her favorite film or your favorite film that Nora Ephron made, which one of these is your favorite Nora Ephron couple?
Harry and Sally, Julia and Paul Child, or Sam and Annie from Sleepless in Seattle?
I have a feeling, of course, that Harry and Sally or Sam and Annie are going to be running away with this one. But at the same time, Julie and Julia, a pretty mediocre film, but that relationship, that central couple, I guess the central couple of one of the storylines with Meryl Streep and Stanley Tucci, they really are a blast to watch on screen.
I would be surprised, yeah, if that one might even come in second. I hear a lot of people talking about that film, how much they loved it, and that is a fascinating relationship. But Harry and Sally, it's going to be the clear winner.
Michael?
I think I like that film a lot, and there was been a bit of a backlash on When Harry Met Sally in the last 10 years or so, and that I think it was such the template for so many inferior versions of that, mm-hmm. including Sleepless in Seattle, frankly, a film I just don't have the same affection for. Also, there's no sex in it. And I just find, you know, I mean, compared to Julie and Julia, I mean, they're having that couple's, you know, marvelously active sex life. You know?
That's right.
And I love seeing Streep and Tucci, the two wiliest scene stealers kind of trading, really taking turns stealing each other's scene. They're fantastic together. But I really think Ephron's writing in When Harry Met Sally makes that kind of formula-bound romantic comedy look effortless and doesn't feel like a formula yet, you know, at that point.
Well, I'll make it 3-for-3. I'm voting Harry and Sally as well. We want to know what you think. Vote now at filmspotting.net. Last week on the show, we were setting up this week's top five, looking back on the last half year in film. What are our favorite films of 2012 so far? And here are the options we gave you. The Avengers, The Cabin in the Woods, Moonrise Kingdom, Prometheus, had to sneak it in there, The Secret World of Eri Eddie, or Other, and you could write in any option you wanted. And there are a lot of films that have come out so far through 6 months, so I figured Other would get a decent number of votes. Josh, how did it come out?
Well, I'm hoping that The Secret World of Eri Eddie is in last place, only because not a lot of people have seen it yet.
I'll be honest, I was surprised you got 5%.
Really?
I actually thought that was a good sign.
Okay.
Because I expect that so few people have, in fact,
maybe
seen
I just don't want to see it in last place. But, yep, 5%. Prometheus, which should be not even on this list, 13%. Other, the catch-all category, has 14%. The Cabin in the Woods, which came out quite a while back now, came in with 15%. And then at the top here, two films, The Avengers with 22%, but beating it by 10% is Moonrise Kingdom, received 32% of the vote.
Wow. A lot of Wes Anderson fans.
For a movie that just came out like 2-3 weeks maybe now,
yeah,
in Chicago at least.
Yeah, and as I look through the other votes that came in, there were a number of films mentioned, as you might imagine. There weren't one or two or three that really ran away with it. Some of them I think will probably come up actually as we go through our list.
Hey, Film Spotting. This is Richard from New York. My favorite film of 2012 so far is Joe Carnahan's The Gray. This is a film that was marketed as another Liam Neeson action spectacular, with Neeson fighting wolves with his bare hands instead of Albanian sex traffickers or January Jones. Fortunately for those watching, it's actually a deeply meditative look at faith, both for survival and the uncaring whims of nature, with the wolves acting as a metaphor for time itself, forcing these men to face those questions head-on or die with them unfulfilled and unanswered. Audiences expected the question, do you have what it takes to survive to be in this film? But what they didn't expect was, do you even want to? Keep up the fantastic work, gentlemen, and I can't wait to see The Avengers squarely at the top of Adam's Best Of list.
Richard in New York with that voicemail helps us transition into our top five this week, our top five films of 2012 so far. An interesting pick there, The Gray, the Joe Carnahan film, the Liam Neeson action movie. He called it a deeply meditative look at faith, and I'm sorry to disappoint him about The Avengers. It's not going to top my list. I know he was really hoping for that. Spoiler alert, The Avengers won't make my list. Unfortunately, The Gray isn't going to make my list either because I still have not had a chance to catch up with it, and I've been meaning to for quite some time because I thought it looked like a really interesting film. Josh, I know you liked the film.
Yeah, I did. I liked it maybe not quite as much as that. It's not simply an action film, but in terms of the faith and the spiritual level, it's kind of heavy-handed on some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have gravitated to it for that, though, so it's definitely striking a chord.
Okay. Well, The Gray is a great pick. Thank you, Richard, for that. We'll hear a couple more voicemails as we get further into the show. And Richard's voicemail is helpful as well because, as I said, I haven't seen The Gray. There are other movies I wish I had seen before we sat down to make our list here of our top five films of the year so far. So I'm going to actually give you the top five films of 2012 I still need to see. I'm starting with number five, the French thriller Sleepless Night.
I'm sorry, I'm not comfortable with the premise of this.
No, item. Okay.
I just feel like we're on very slippery. Yeah.
My number four is Crazy Horse, the Frederick Wiseman documentary on the Paris New Dancing Club. Sticking with the horse theme, Dark Horse, the new Todd Solondz film, is my number three pick. I still need to see. Damsels in Distress is my number two, the Whit Stillman film. And then my number one is the movie Alps. This is the Yorgos Lanthimos movie, the Greek director who made Dogtooth, one of my favorite movies from, was it last year or the year before? I can't remember anymore. This is his new movie. Very fascinating premise. It played at the Siskel here in Chicago for just a week, and unfortunately I could not make it. I really do hope to catch up with that film at some point. Do you guys have any disclaimers you want to put out there about movies you need to catch up with still?
I'll add all those to the list. Yeah, okay. I definitely want to see those. And yeah, we kind of have to protect ourselves. Whenever you put together a list like this, you just feel a lot of shame for what you've missed rather than maybe enjoy what you've seen and
exactly.
really appreciated. So
that's why I had to
I'm glad
get that
you got
out
that
there.
Out of the way.
Yeah, I had to get my shame out there for everyone to enjoy.
I mean, on some episodes, I think of film spotting are more faith-based. This is a really shame-based one.
It is.
Yeah,
exactly.
It is, in fact.
Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and start the shaming. Michael. Your number five film of the year so far.
All right. You probably won't be expecting this, and this is a film that did not particularly find a big audience. It didn't get tons and tons of love, but for me, in the top five, number five is The 5-Year Engagement.
Really?
Yes, it is. It's speaking of a romantic comedy that didn't feel entirely formulaic and actually took its characters in some interesting and somewhat challenging directions, and it's a couple played by Emily Blunt and Jason Segel that really did divide my sympathies in a good way, didn't villainize anybody, and really kind of wasn't afraid to muck around in a lot of gray area when a couple doesn't know if it's going to work out mm-hmm. or not.
The men will wear yarmulkes.
And in that case, all eligible Christians will be served communion.
Communion? What, we're going to have communion at my son's wedding?
It's our wedding, Pete, and I mean, seeing as everyone's going to be wearing yarmulkes.
Well, actually, only the men will be wearing yarmulkes, so.
Well, I've never heard you say the word yarmulke till today.
Excuse me, I say yarmulke all the time.
You don't.
Like, hey, where's my yarmulke, babe?
Babe,
have you seen my yarmulke?
You don't have a yarmulke.
I have a whole, it's in my Jewish drawer.
I really went for it, and I laughed a lot. It's a little too long. It's like a lot of Judd Apatow-related material. It's about 15 minutes too long. They don't really have a satisfying wrap-up. I think if they had found a way to cut 15, 20 minutes, it would have found more of an audience than it did. But I found that this was, interestingly, the most controversial recommendation of a mainstream commercial movie I made this year, at least in the
really?
Pages and online with the Tribune. In other words, this is the one where I got the most, you're an idiot. You know, you're an idiot. And
just for appreciating
it? I need my money back, and I resent the fact that you sent me to this movie with your recommendation, and I'm not kidding, I need
wow.
my money back.
Wow.
I really do need my money back. That's how these emails, you know, you can tell it's tough times when they actually stress it three times, and then
right.
P.S., I'm not kidding, I need that $18 back.
Well, The 5-Year Engagement, I guess I'm going to have to make this actually my top six films that I'm ashamed I haven't seen.
You haven't seen it?
No, I really didn't, and I have no excuse other than too many movies to fit in, but the fact is, I like Judd Apatow-related films, as you mentioned. I like Nicholas Stoller and Jason Segel when they work together. This really was constantly on my list. When I have that extra 2 hours, I'm going to see The 5-Year Engagement. I didn't make it. So.
Josh, did you see it?
Haven't seen it either. Consider me shamed.
Wow.
See, this really is
I'm sorry. I'm
shaming.
Leaving. That's it. I'm out of here.
I've actually only seen five movies, and they're my top five.
So, I knew it.
Yeah, Magic Mike is six, so we'll see if it fits
I knew
in.
It was a bad sign when you were saying, hey, maybe we should just do a top two.
There you go. Josh, you're number five.
I have an uncool pick for number five, even though this received largely favorable reviews, but it's The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
I've seen it twice, and with its criticisms in mind, I'm well aware of its criticisms, and it still stands as a strong piece of speculative sci-fi for me. Director Gary Ross's frenetic camera work was thematically appropriate in my mind. More importantly, he established a really strong sense of place, which I think the novel lacked. Jennifer Lawrence gives her best performance since Winter's Bone. It's very similar, but still, it is a very good performance, especially when the role of Katniss is considered in terms of gender expectations, and it really foreshadows Brave in ways mm-hmm. other than just the archery, I think. So I think The Hunger Games works really well as social critique of our reality TV era, and that's something the best sci-fi does. I just get this feeling that people are going to look back on this film. It's just too caught up in all the hype and the hysteria and the Hunger Games craziness. 10, 15 years, they look back on this, and they'll see this as a strong piece of sci-fi.
No. I don't think they will.
They will see this as a stronger piece of sci-fi than Prometheus.
Really? Prometheus?
Yeah, I'll say that right now.
You mean, speaking of uncool picks and criticisms, my number five film of the year so far.
Let's just get it out of the way.
It is Ridley Scott's Prometheus. I had to put it on here, I think, just because I wanted to make sure I had at least one pick that neither of you guys would put on. Though, Michael, you were mostly with me
in enjoying the film. I'm a uniter, not a divider.
Exactly.
I like both The Hunger Games.
It's probably a good thing he's here.
I don't love either, but I like both The Hunger Games and Prometheus. And,
okay.
Which is better, Michael?
Which is better? Oh, make me pick. Oh,
There's no fence riding here.
Co-host do you like better?
Exactly. That's basically what we're asking.
Pick a team.
You know, honestly, what I do like about The Hunger Games a lot, it what has stuck with me, and just to see how those books flew through my son's middle school class. I mean, they all read all three. And this whole question about, is it too rough? Is PG-13? Is it really too rough for young kids? For young kids, yes. What I like about the film, though, Josh, is largely Gary Ross's contribution in that the killing really does matter. Like, the death matters in that film, and so much of our kids' lives is, you know, whether it's gaming or at the movies or whatever, or television, it's all about sort of just, you know, mindless, you know, none of the killing is supposed to matter. And here you have an admittedly sadistic premise where it's all about surviving another round of death, of battle, of combat, various means. But the death in The Hunger Games is supposed to matter, and I appreciate that.
That means it's better than Prometheus, Adam. But go on.
That's all you took away from that, isn't it? You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam Campanar, Josh Larson, and our special guest, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. We're sharing our top five films of 2012 so far, and I already divulged my number five. It is, in fact, Ridley Scott's Prometheus. After 20 minutes talking about it on our 400th show a few weeks ago, and 40 minutes going into more detail with Dana Stevens on the Slate spoiler special, and then 25 more minutes in bonus content fighting about it with you, Josh, I'm not sure how much more I can say. I will certainly acknowledge again that I am on board with several of the common criticisms of the film, including a few of my own. But the fact is, the sheer spectacle of that first hour, the engineer in the prologue, Fassbender alone on the ship, the touchdown on the planet, and the discovery of what they were there to discover and then trying to make sense of it all, that won me over and made up for so much that doesn't work later in the film. And I think ultimately, as we fought about, the fact that this movie has fostered this much discussion, this much wrangling on the internet, this much passion, and given me and other people who've enjoyed it a desire to dive in and dissect it and really try to understand it, I think that's a good thing. I think there are elements that are legitimately just bad storytelling, but I think there are other elements that are successfully ambiguous. And for that, I thank Ridley Scott.
This really better not end up on your top 10.
We'll see. We'll see. It's number five right now. Michael Phillips, your number four film of the year so far.
My number four is Joseph Seder's film Footnote from Israel, one of my favorite comedies of the last couple of years. And it's this bitterly funny story of a father-son rivalry, two very different professors in the field of Talmudic history and scholarship. And it's a marvelous sort of Job-like parable about a terrible mistake where an award that's meant, a shining career topping award.
It's meant for the son, right?
Meant
but
for
they
the son,
give it to the father.
They mistakenly call the father and they have to take it back from him, and this competitive relationship just festers and gets worse, and the son can do no right in the situation. I love this comedy, even, again, like the 5-year engagement, even though the last 15 minutes doesn't quite know what it's about. I guess it makes me realize how much I'll forgive if the film's got any kind of texture and personality to call its own. I really love that film. It's a splitter. I remember showing it to a group, and they stared at it, and they, you know, it's a film that if you don't start laughing in the first 10 minutes,
probably
or
won't.
Finding it funny anyway. Did you guys see it?
No, unfortunately.
You didn't see Footnote.
Another one for the shameless.
Yep.
Shame.
Add it
shame
to the list.
I'm here really to shame you.
You are.
Okay.
That's why we bring you on, Michael.
This is the island of New Penzance.
16 miles long, forested with old-growth pine and maple, crisscrossed by shallow tidal creeks. Chickchaw territory.
My number four was the winner for our poll, Moonrise Kingdom. I've only seen it once, and I feel like second viewing is really required of all Wes Anderson films to properly place them. But I have a lot of affection for the summery fussiness that this movie has. It's maybe as loose and laid back as Anderson gets, and that's not to mean that the movie is loose and laid back, but it, for his films, it has that sort of feel. I've talked before about how the island as a community is the real focus of the film, but I'm eager for a second viewing to more closely observe some of the supporting performances of these community members, because I'm always fascinated with how Anderson works in new faces to his ensemble. And there are some great ones here. There's Frances McDormand, Bruce Willis, Edward Norton in particular. I want to watch a little more closely because there were times where he seemed to be right in step with Anderson's diction and what he was doing. And then other times where I would thought, oh, he's maybe trying to catch up or match the pace. So I really want to watch it again to dig more closely into those performances.
Moonrise Kingdom, the new Wes Anderson film. It's a great pick. My number four is a film that gets its title from the old aphorism about being caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. It is The Deep Blue Sea, Terrence Davies' film. Rachel Weisz plays Hester. She's married to a high court judge. It's the very model of a modern English passionless marriage. Think of Brief Encounter. But in this case, for Hester, it's not only safe and comforting, she's actually very compatible with her husband, culturally and intellectually. And then she meets Freddie, played brilliantly, I think, by Tom Hiddleston. What a year he had. He's younger. They've got tremendous sexual chemistry, but it's very volatile. And so she's got to kind of take her pick. She can either be suffocated in one relationship or basically be driven to madness in the other. And that's what we see play out over the course of this film. Like other Terrence Davies films that I've seen, you sort of float along with this movie. It's nonlinear and you just are kind of out in the ether. And it's grounded like Distant Voices, Still Lives in post-war Liverpool in that case. But there's this heightened sense of reality. It's almost like this couple here are the only people who exist in the world, even as they're maybe in a pub and everyone around them is singing some old song from back during the war. There's this sense of isolation within a larger community that I think Davies is interested in exploring. It's based on a Terence Rattigan play. You can definitely tell that it's based on a play in terms of its smallness and the way it's set up, and it's very dialogue heavy. But I also really like the way the characters grapple with their words and really think about the consequences of their words. I love his use of tableau shots. Here you've got an amazing sequence in the underground where it almost looks like a photograph, the way the characters are so still, but the camera's moving, this gorgeous tracking shot following them as they sing. It's really pretty breathtaking, one of my favorite moments of the year.
I'm still chewing over that one because I did see it in preparation for this show, and I'm kind of torn. The tableau shots are, I mean, they're enough to win me over. Mm-hmm. I definitely like the film. Not enough to bump it on this list because I'm still struggling over that story and what it offers beyond the same narrative we've seen so many times before. And if that matters, maybe it doesn't matter because of what Davies brings to it in terms of the style and the visuals. So kind of torn on it right now.
I can understand that reaction.
Yeah, both films you mentioned here, The Deep Blue Sea and Moonrise Kingdom, are just not – I mean, they may end up in 6 months' time, really. These films have to kind of live with you a little while. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of realize, okay, in a funny way, they just missed my top five in June. By November, December, you start to realize Davies is an important enough writer-director. And his adaptation of the Rattigan play is actually pretty radically different than the play itself. Moonrise Kingdom, too, I feel like – it's great to have a film that's this much in the conversation that in its limited release way is really drawing an audience. And even when people are coming back feeling like, well, it's a little oversold for me, or I don't love it like I love Rushmore, nonetheless, nobody feels like it's a slovenly piece of work,
right,
that, you know, like Anderson's way off his game or something like that. It's just both films are really, really strong.
And I think it is worth noting, as you point out, Michael, that we reserve the right to completely change our minds at the end of the year when we're all sitting here again sharing our top 10 films of the year. We may throw all of these movies out. They may be in completely different order. That's just the way we choose to do it. You're going to have to deal with it.
Well, I'm starting to worry you guys didn't do your homework and see That's My Boy in preparation for our list.
Another one from my shame list.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out with your final picks for the top five movies of the year next. Stay with us.
Even in an evening gown, you always got your sleeves rolled all the way down. messages you wrote were to be read aloud. A laundry list in a clenched fist never meant to be shown. Can you read my mind? Then how was my day today? Ask the river to divide. What does the river say? Flash of bone, like a lightning strike. Ran down the line, shot up your spine, like a shorted out mic.
Josh, it's time to say thank you this week to our very many generous Film Spotting listeners who sent us some of their hard-earned cash in support of the show. This segment, as always, brought to you by Jeff Goldsmith and his Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith podcast. They've got a 90-plus minute show this week chronicling the artist behind the Sundance horror film, The Pact. It takes a close look at what goes into making an independent film and features three of the actors, Starship Troopers' own Casper Van Dien, Haley Hudson, and Mark Steger, along with The Pact's first-time writer-director, Nicholas McCarthy. You can get that show by doing a search for the Q&A in iTunes or just click on the link in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net.
And don't forget to check out Jeff Goldsmith's newly launched digital magazine on the iPad, Backstory, where you can read a script in its entirety, watch a short film, and, of course, get insight into the art and business of storytelling. The app and issue 01 of Backstory are free in the iPad App Store.
Definitely something to look out for. I wish I owned an iPad so I could get Backstory for myself.
Be nice, wouldn't it?
Well, that's going to be maybe the Film Spotting Christmas present to ourselves, Josh.
Oh, I like it.
The iPad would be nice. Thank you, Jeff. And we do want to also mention an email we got from a local film enthusiast from a site called Keeping It Real. His name's David J. Fowley. And one of the largest one-theater movie houses in the city, it's called the Patio Theater, desperately needs help. They need a digital projector in order to keep up with the times, and they've got a Kickstarter campaign created to help raise money to make that happen. They've got a little over 20 grand already pledged, but the goal is to get to 50, and they have less than a month to go. J.R. Jones from the Chicago Reader had it as his best new movie theater of 2011. Roger Ebert's talked about it on his site. He's also pledged to the campaign. And David says, you have a powerful voice in the Chicago community, not to mention worldwide. Flattery will get you everywhere,
wow.
David. Spread the word, host an event there, and or let people know about the need. So I don't know about hosting an event there. It sounds like a lovely theater from the pictures I've seen online. It really looks like it would be fun to do something there, and maybe we can someday.
Well, we've done two of the three here. We're spreading the word, letting people know.
Spreading the word. Yeah. That's our goal, at least here. We'll put a link in the notes for the show if you're interested in supporting their campaign. Let's get to our donations and our thank yous this week, Josh, starting with some very generous $10 a month donors to the show.
Chris from Creedmoor, North Carolina, and Larry Niffing from Yokohama, Japan.
And Larry wrote in and said, sorry, it's been so long between donations. It's the best money I ever spent. I don't think that's probably true, Larry, but we appreciate it. He also did a nice write-up about Film Spotting on his blog. We'll also link to that. Thank you, Larry. Mike from Worcester, Mass. also donated $10 a month to Film Spotting.
I've been a faithful listener for almost 2 years now, and I can't say how grateful I am to be in your company, on my drive to work anyway. Now I'm up to episode 140 in the archives, and I have to say my appreciation and affection for what you two do, and Sam and Maddie before you, has only increased. Despite Adams admitting a few months ago that he's never seen one of my all-time favorite films, Bill Forsyth's Local Hero, I've been meaning to donate but never seemed to get around to it. Well, no more procrastinating. All I can say is, mi PayPal es su PayPal. I love the podcast and truly appreciate the hard work that surely goes into it. Thanks, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much for the donation and those nice sentiments there, Mike. As you get through more shows, you'll find, I think, the Local Hero comes up again. I already got shamed for having not seen Local Hero by Michael Phillips at Ebert Fest a few years ago. He couldn't
just
believe I hadn't seen it.
He just shames you constantly,
yeah,
doesn't he?
It's true. And so I sat down a few months after that, and I did watch Local Hero, and I think it's a really good film, Burt Lancaster in that movie. So it's one that hasn't come up in Film Spotting Top 5 yet, but surely will at some point. New $5 a month donors, Jeremy in Brooklyn, Ontario, Canada, and Gregory in Hong Kong.
I wanted to drop you a quick note to express my appreciation for all your efforts, including posting the show for iPhone app users on Thursday evenings, which are my Friday mornings. I don't get an opportunity to enjoy a lot of the new domestic films you discuss until many months after their U.S. releases, often catching them in flight on Cathay Pacific Airways before, if they are theatrically available in Hong Kong. Nevertheless, I eagerly anticipate your insightful and spoiler-free discussions of new films every week, as well as your movie marathons, top five lists, and, of course, Massacre Theater. P.S. I got a kick out of Adam's Melancholy of a Lost Dog short film on filmspotting.net, especially because it was shot around my old neighborhood of Belmont Broadway in the late 90s.
Yeah, that's where I lived when I was here in Chicago for film school and shot my movie right in that neighborhood. Melrose Diner played a prominent role in my film. And hey, how can I not mention that he's a fan of my movie?
He's a fan of your
the
work.
The one movie I made, the 1 7-minute movie I made that is available on filmspotting.net that you have to hunt around for it a little bit.
So yeah, I haven't actually watched it.
That's
so
fine.
I'll put it on my to-do list.
You don't need to. We have other movies I think are more pressing. Josh, as always, we want to thank all of our monthly donors. We also have a new Buck a Show donor, David L. Williams. Used to be from New York. Now he's in Bellefont, Pennsylvania.
I've been listening to Film Spotting since the summer of 2005, back when it was Cinecast and it was twice a week, and I'm happy to donate a buck a show. 400 episodes and a live show? Our little baby's all grown up. P.S. Still waiting for a top five movies adapted from plays.
We've talked about that a few different times. In fact, recently we threw that out there because it tied in with, I don't know, The Cabin in the Woods.
Probably.
I can't remember what film it was, but there was some film based on a play. And it is problematic because you kind of want to feel like you've read the play or seen the production in order to comment on the adaptation. That does limit your options, unfortunately. But David, it's a great idea. I'm sure we will get to it at some point. A new Silver Club donor, Derek in Coburg, Ontario, Canada. Other donors we want to thank, Matthias in Oslo, Norway, Michael in Great Mills, Maryland, Dominic in Rattingen, Germany, Simon in Mangakino, New Zealand, and finally, Ivan in Silver Spring, Maryland.
My latest short film, Baggage, is done, and I'm about to start the arduous festival submission process. As I'm sure you know, festival entry fees are expensive. Even mid-level festivals charge a considerable fee just for the opportunity to have your film be rejected. In turn, I'm trying to lighten the monetary onus by starting a modest Kickstarter campaign, and we'll include the link to his campaign in the show notes.
Ivan's been a longtime listener and supporter of the show. We wish him all the best with the film. Thanks again to everybody who donated this week.
Let the poor girl bleed all the while.
Hi, this is Andrew Stanton. I'm the director of films like Finding Nemo and WALL-E, and now John Carter, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
Hey guys, this is Ben Flanagan from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. My favorite film of 2012 so far was Michael Douce's hilarious hockey comedy Goon, until last week when I caught up with Pixar's Brave. The story, the heart, the overall design, and yes, Josh, even the comedy, put this in the top half of my favorite Pixar movies. And while the backlash might have had to do with so many people not getting what they expected going into Brave, I did share that experience and really couldn't be more grateful that Pixar defied those expectations. Thanks a lot, guys. Keep up the great work, and roll tide.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson and our special guest Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. I'm Adam Kempinar. Film Spotting Top 5 this week is our top 5 films of 2012 so far, sort of taking stock of where we are with the year. And you just heard one of our listeners, Ben, in Tuscaloosa with his pick, Brave, really won over by the Pixar film, says it's in the top half of his favorite Pixar films ever, which I think is a pretty bold statement.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know.
You like Brave a lot, Josh.
I did like it a lot. Instinctually, I would say no to that, but it's early still.
Okay. Well, Ben, we appreciate the voicemail. Let's get back to our countdown. Michael, what's your number 3 film of the year?
My number 3 was a film not many people saw. It had a week's run at the Siskel, but it's the animated feature that's a co-production, a Spanish-British co-production. It was called Chico and Rita, which was a really cool feature set in the world of Cubano jazz and sort of bebop in the post-World War II era. It's a love story between a jazz pianist and a vocalist, and it's set in Havana, New York City, Hollywood. It touches on everything from, you know, sort of institutional racism in the show business world in the U.S. versus how things are in Cuba, I just thought it was one of the most bracing animated features I've seen in years. It's not for kids, really. I haven't seen that much animated nudity since the heyday of Ralph Bakshi, you know, back in but it's got wonderful music, and it's got a really assured visual style in that it's kind of shot like an old 40s Hollywood studio, you know, melodrama with music. It's got a lot of the Michael Curtiz kind of like, you know, swoopy diagonal stuff going. It's got wonderful kind of, they do a lot without conventional cuts that you see so often in animated films, not just live action today. It's a film I just really can't recommend highly enough. Chico and Rita. Bésame, bésame mucho, como si fuera esta noche la última vez.
Well, for those of you who maybe just tuned in or who have been zoning out throughout this show, Michael, with your number five, The Five-Year Engagement, your number four, Footnote, and now Chico and Rita at number three, basically your list is the top five movies Adam and Josh still need to see.
Pretty much.
Okay.
I'm comfortable with that. I'm not saying I'm more special than you guys.
I think that's what you're trying to say.
You're implying it.
I'm not saying I'm any less special.
Josh, your number five and number four, quickly recap and then give us your number three.
Number five was The Hunger Games. Number four, Moonrise Kingdom. And that brings me to number three, The Secret World of Arrietty. Has the little people conceit been done better in terms of visuals? I don't think I've seen it. This is an adaptation of the children's novel, The Borrowers, about tiny people who live in a house and scavenge everyday items. And the film is so attentive to their unique perspective. It's not just that things are big. You know, that's what we expect. That's the obvious thing that a movie is going to do. But it's also that things move and sound differently to Arrietty and her family. When leaves gently lilt in the wind, it's like the sail of a giant ship. That's what it moves like. The crickets outside, we think of them as lulling us to sleep. It's kind of a comforting sound. But here in this movie, they're roaring beasts. So altogether, this film, it's a lot of small pleasures, but they really do add up to great art.
Yeah, The Secret World of Arrietty is a film I definitely strongly considered, but did just miss my list. I'm glad it made yours. My number three film, unfortunately, I can't continue the animation theme with your number three picks, but it is a film from a filmmaker who's made an animated film, and the film is one, in fact, that was supposed to have an animated ending, and the director, Wes Anderson, chose to go in a different direction. My number three is your number four, Moonrise Kingdom. And it's a movie, Michael, I really like what you said about The Deep Blue Sea, where it's a film that you feel like maybe 6 months from now it'll grow on you, or it may even have more depth and more resonance as the movie year goes on. Moonrise Kingdom, for me, is one that since I saw it, whatever it was, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, has only grown in my estimation and made me really want to go back and revisit it. And as I was forming my list, it did occur to me that there was a similar theme throughout my picks, which was that they were made by directors who I felt like the movies all sort of had their fingerprints definitely on it. The same way we talked about Soderbergh with Magic Mike, I think that Prometheus has elements of Ridley Scott's fingerprint in terms of the thematic tie-in to a movie like Blade Runner and the way he represents scale in his shots, the tableau and the ethereal quality you see in Terrence Davies in The Deep Blue Sea, my number four pick. And then you get to this movie, Moonrise Kingdom. I'm not sure you could have a more Wes Anderson film than Moonrise Kingdom. And I think, actually, I wonder if it maybe isn't his best film. If you could sort of divorce yourself from any nostalgia, I still go back to Rushmore. That was a movie that came out when I was in film school, and I really embraced it. And The Royal Tenenbaums was his follow-up, and I felt like, wow, this filmmaker is amazing. Some of his other work tailed off for me a little bit. I saw those two films before I had seen Bottle Rocket. I really had this strong connection for them. I don't know that I can divorce myself from that, but if someone came along, had never even heard of Wes Anderson and just watched his filmography, I wonder if Moonrise Kingdom wouldn't feel like a sort of culmination and maybe feel like his masterwork. I think that the coming of age story is really fascinating. As a survival guide, the whole film is kind of its own how-to guide. The really striking color palette with the grainy Super 16 look to the movie is something I still really reflect on and can envision in my head perfectly some of the scenes from that movie. I love the performances as well. Some of the great moments from the ensemble, like with Ed Norton in that movie. So Moonrise Kingdom is my number three.
Yeah, that's interesting. I could see people coming around to it as Wes Anderson's best. You already feel that vibe coming from some folks. And I've had conversations with people. It's interesting with him. Whatever Wes Anderson film they see first tends to be his masterwork to them. So it sounds like somewhat that happened to you, and even some people who I've heard who this is their first Wes Anderson film. They're just in love with it.
Although I've never heard that anyone say that about The Life Aquatic. You know,
I like The Life Aquatic, actually.
I know a few Film Spotting listeners who love The Life Aquatic and love to take me to task for
best of all?
Not
best
appreciating
of all?
It. Yeah, I think actually there are a few out there. They're probably they're dilettantes. The they're just trying to be different, Michael.
Exactly. I think your whole your listenership is very very shoddy. I think the peculiar thing about a director as talented, but a guy who works in a somewhat narrow key, like Wes Anderson, you go back and you can change your mind about his films and the kind of the order in which you maybe it is a question of which one you came to first. A film I saw again only after 2 or 3 years, Fantastic Mr. Fox, film I was a little cool toward the first time. That film almost doubled in value for me by 2 or 3 years later, and I'm not exactly sure why yet. And, you know, someday I'll figure it out. But in a way, that had an emotional component that I'm not dead sure is there for me in Moonrise Kingdom with the central characters of the young – you know, the young adolescent sort of, you know, would-be lovers.
Yeah.
That said, like Dana Stevens was saying on the show, too, when we talked about it the other week, even if you're not completely seduced or swayed by the emotional content of the film, there is so much else going on in the thing, visually in a lot of other ways, musically. It's crazy to dismiss it.
I agree certainly with that sentiment. Michael, what is your number two film of 2012 so far? And please tell me I've actually seen it.
No, you haven't.
Okay.
No, because apparently the theme with my mid-year recap is that these are films nobody will ever see. And by the end of the year, I'm going to throw them off the list anyway.
Okay.
As long
as we all know that.
Yes. It's called The Color Wheel. Do you know anything about The Color Wheel, guys?
Absolutely.
What's this Color Wheel you speak of? Tell us, Michael.
Okay, it played 1 week at Facets. In fact, I think it's finishing up its run this week at Facets. And it's a film by Alex Ross Perry, who co-wrote it with Carlin Altman. They play brother and sister. There's two of the more comically unpleasant and kind of mismatched brothers and sisters I've ever seen in any film. It's a black and white 16mm road movie shot by the same cinematographer who did Frownland, another indie that very, very few people saw. But there is something going on in Frownland and especially in The Color Wheel that it's a kind of comedy of anxiety of characters right on the edge of some really painful discoveries it's just one of the best truly painful comedies I've seen in a long time. And that is apparently, again, my mid-year theme between this footnote and the five-year engagement. There's something about the comedy of anxiety that is completely turning my crank this year.
I guess so.
Yeah. Do I seem anxious to you?
We'll have to get into that sometime. Maybe.
Yes.
Do I seem a little edgy?
Am I a little edgy?
A little bit.
A little anxious?
Yeah.
Okay.
You were edgy in that dog performance, that's for sure.
Anyway, see The Color. We'll see what you think of it. It's got a sense of humor really almost unlike anything I've seen lately.
I'm fascinated. Josh, you're number two.
My number two, the three of us actually talked about on this show. My mind still drifts off in moments to some of the stunning Turkish landscapes in Once Upon a Time in Anatolia from writer-director Nuri Bilge Ceylan. The story, though, also does resonate for me, and it's really needling at me, actually. I'm trying to puzzle just what the movie might be saying about our contemporary society's obsessive pursuit of justice and truth. It centers around a police search for the body of a murder victim, but the suspense here really is all interior. Despite those landscapes I talked about, it feels like an interior film at the same time. It's a bravura intertwining of cinematic flourishes and also intellectual provocation. So I really want to dig into this one again as well.
Absolutely. I'm with you on that film. Ceylan is one of those directors we've talked about. I think we both need to see more of his work. Michael, you've been proselytizing for him for years here on this show and in the Tribune. One of these days, we're going to actually listen to you and watch more of Ceylan's movies. My number two is a film that could not be more different than your number two pick. It's one that I wish back in May, Michael, when you were here for your appearance, and it came up. I wish I could have joined in the conversation more, but I hadn't seen it at that time. It would have been a fun conversation because, Michael, well, actually, you both got it wrong. Michael, you didn't really appreciate it at all, and Josh, you didn't appreciate it enough, and it's Jeff Who Lives at Home.
Hmm.
Did you get the wood glue? What are you talking about?
I left you a note on the kitchen counter.
I haven't been upstairs.
One of the shutters on the pantry is broken, and I need you to fix it.
You know, I'm kind of busy right now, so...
All I want for my birthday is for you to get your
ass off that couch, and you get on the bus,
and you go to the Home
Depot. Couch.
You come home, you fix the shutter before I get home, or you're going to find someplace else to live.
Fine.
Fine.
Good. You got it? Do you understand?
Yes, Mom. Okay.
Love you.
Goodbye.
Did you just hang up on me?
I am a very big fan, obviously, not only of the Duplass brothers, but of this movie. And the authorial stamp here, if you will, is The Lovable Loser on a Quest, a film that's ostensibly a comedy, but really goes to some dark places. And it wouldn't be a Duplass brothers movie if I didn't love it. Jason Segel, he lives in his mom's basement. He's unemployed. He's looking for signs for what to do with the rest of his life. And Ed Helms is his brother. Not a good guy, having his own problems, married to Judy Greer, and their marriage is on its last legs. This movie, as it goes through this quest, all the storylines, all the characters do come together and intersect. For me, in a way that's really fascinating, really effective, and actually just follows through on the promise that the filmmakers gave us in the opening lines of the film. So some of the reactions to it in terms of it being overly dramatic, maybe overly melodramatic, and not buying it, I think the movie gives it to us, gives us a roadmap right at the beginning of this film. So it's one that really worked for me. And I actually want to read quickly an email here from a listener, Brandon Bayer in Cincinnati, Ohio. He wrote in back when this movie came out, and he said that while there are many things that didn't work for him in the film, I will ignore them all for what I feel is one of the most real moments I've seen on film. I suppose it should be expected from the Duplass brothers at this point, but the scene where Ed Helms and his wife, the ubiquitous Judy Greer, are having a fight in a hotel is more honest than anything I've seen in years. While I've worried that the mumblecore movement going mainstream might rob it from its truthfulness, the scene rocked me to my core. While the final act of the movie is all convention, cute payoff, and has some timeline issues, I find that the honesty that brought us to that point gives it a pass. This film, while not perfect, really touched me. So that's Brandon, and I read that because, obviously, I like the film more than him. I do think the final act and the payoff is kind of brilliant, but I think that that conversation is exactly the scene that he's talking about, where this whole movie will hinge for you if you see it. I was kind of going along meandering with this movie as the main character is meandering through the film. And that moment in the hotel room that hits on some really dark, interesting notes, it completely won me over and felt like finally I knew what the Duplass brothers were trying to do with this movie. And from then on, it was clear sailing. So I love it. Maybe it's one as we go through the year. Who knows? Maybe it will seem a little bit more trivial than some of these other films, and maybe it will move down. But right now, Jeff Who Lives at Home is a movie that I really loved.
That is a great moment, and I did enjoy the film, so I'm not going to debate you. But, Michael, what were your problems with it?
Adam, you used the word, some people said it was overly melodramatic. How could you use the word
the ending of the film?
But how?
Yeah.
No, there's nothing overly about this film. It doesn't try hard enough in any direction.
It goes for something at the end.
But again, I guess if the storytelling and the humor didn't strike me as so flat, I guess I just feel that this is. I like a lot of the Duplass's work. I really like Puffy Chair and Baghead. These guys, separately and together, have real talent.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that they found a way to kind of sell the sort of stories and character portraits they're interested in. I think that sometimes when filmmakers, with their preoccupations, get the kind of casts together that 5 years earlier they only dreamed about getting, like Susan Sarandon. Okay, we'll get Susan Sarandon.
Yeah.
We'll get Judy Greer, who's tremendously good, I think, in The Descendants and here too. Ed Helms, these are highly skilled people, and the material does start to seem kind of puny when the more skillful actors get a hold of it. Now, maybe I'll try it again sometime.
Okay, we'll both give it a shot. We'll come back in 6 months and see where we stand on Jeff Who Lives at Home, my number two pick. That brings us to our number one. You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam, Josh, Michael Phillips from the Tribune sharing our top five films of the year so far. What is your top pick, Mr. Phillips?
Josh Larson already stole it from me. It's that Nuri Bilge Ceylan.
I've seen that one.
Film. Yes. Once
finally.
Yes. It's a film with the art house title that sounds like the most medicinal load of pain ever. Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. But it is a beautiful picture. And, Josh, you've already described it wonderfully. It's a simple story that sounds like it's going to just be kind of a, you know, CSI Turkey in a way. You know, just a procedural trying to find a body that's
yeah,
been...
it's a police commissioner and a prosecutor and the suspect, and they're looking for the body.
Looking for the body.
He says he killed.
And
can't remember where he left.
Right, and just like a lot of, you know, like a lot of great literature, it's not what's going on, it's what's going on behind the eyes of the people involved. And you just learn so much in so many sharp and truthful little moments about what are really haunting these characters, why we can in a way relate to every one of them, whether they're a murderer or a police detective or just a doctor who's kind of trying to make sense of it all.
Yeah.
This is a film that if you like Bellatar's films, Turin Horse, which is a film that didn't quite make my top five, but if you can adjust your rhythm in the first half hour to what the director's up to, and if you have the urge to flee because not enough is happening, if you hang in there, I just guarantee that by the end of Anatolia, you're going to find some greatness.
Well, Josh, I was actually surprised a little bit. I thought Once Upon a Time in Anatolia might be your number one, so I'm very intrigued to get your number one
pick. I thought about it. It was almost there, but then I saw just a few weeks ago Beasts of the Southern Wild. And I'm going to keep this brief because we're hoping to review this on an upcoming show in a week or two. I value, I think, above all else in movies, originality, and Beasts has it in spades. This is set in the bathtub. It's what they call this lowland society whose residents have refused to move to higher ground despite the continual threat of flooding. And the movie's told through the eyes of a young girl who lives there with her father. The movie combines fantasy, it has social realism, and also this sense of apocalyptic urgency. And the amazing thing is it makes all that work. It comes together and it works. This movie is not a mess, even though it sounds like it should be. For now, I'm just going to let others' praise speak for me. This won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance and also won the Best First Feature Film Award at Cannes.
Well, there you go. It's hard to argue with those credentials. Have you seen Beasts of the Southern Wild, Michael?
I have. I'm less keen on it, but I have to see it one more time before writing
away
about it.
Away from the festival, or did you see it at Cannes?
I saw it at Cannes, which was late in the cycle, because it's a film that, like many films, was really launched at Sundance, and you know, plenty of very strong critical praise from Manola Dargis and the New York Times on down to Josh Larson. Not down, just over. Okay, just over.
I understand what
from
you're
Manola
saying.
From Manola Dargis over to
no
Josh
No offense
Larson.
Taken, I'm sure.
But I found, you know, oddly, I found the technique of that film a little pushy for me, and I felt like it was sort of working too hard for me to get an honest emotion back to it. But
it's very stylized.
But people love it. The people who love it really love
it.
Yeah,
and I can understand it being off-putting as well because of the leaps it makes and the style it kind of forces on you a little bit. So
haven't written about it yet, though, so in a way I'm at that...
little wiggle room, yeah.
I'm in that ambiguous period where I haven't really worked out exactly why I feel the way I do about it. But mixed, certainly not a dismissible film.
As you said, Josh, we're hoping to talk about it on an upcoming show, maybe even as early as next week. I will see it before we dive into that film. Unfortunately, I can't comment on it now. My number one film of the year, Josh, you ruined it. We could have made this 3 for 3. We could have had Once Upon a Time in Anatolia as our triumvirate pick
number
here.
Number one, I should have.
For the best film, Nuri Bilge Ceylan. But it is for me as well, Michael. I'm with you on this film, and I'll ask the question and answer it the same way I did back when we discussed it a few months ago. Can the combination of cinematography and performances be so assured and fascinating that nothing can happen, virtually nothing happened on screen for 157 minutes, and still be riveted by it? And the answer here was yes for me. And I'm with you that, you know, you kind of have to recalibrate yourself and see if you can get into the rhythm of this movie. I don't really want to say a whole lot more because this is one pick that I know it's almost impossible it won't come up again at the end of the year when we do our top 10. If people want to hear our conversation about it, it was episode 391 of the podcast back in March. So you can go to filmspotting.net and do a search for it or do a search in iTunes. It's grim subject matter. It's grim subject matter, but it's got a really sly sense of humor. It's visually striking in a way that Moonrise Kingdom isn't. It's not nearly as ostentatious. Darker hues. It takes place mostly at night, but still is just breathtaking when you watch some of these shots. The lights, as we talked about, coming from the car lights as they trail through the valley is just really striking. And it does ask fundamental human questions, and explores some of the real mysteries of life and doesn't really give us any kind of easy answers, but it's still very satisfying. It's probably what a lot of us wish Prometheus had been in terms of asking these provocative existential questions and not being merely ambiguous about it, but really kind of giving us something to chew on and wrestle with it ourselves. That's certainly what J-Lon does with this movie. It's a movie, I should mention, did just come out on DVD. So if you're listening to this show and are intrigued, or you think there's no way I'll enjoy this film based on what they're saying about it, that's fine too. It did just come out on DVD and Blu-ray, as did Jeff Who Lives at Home.
And don't watch it on, I hate to say it, but do not watch Once Upon a Time in Anatolia on a small screen. Don't watch it on anything you can hold in your hand.
Yeah,
it
I agree.
I mean, it needs the widest, biggest screen you can get. And it's always tricky, I think, guys, to talk about a film's visual quality and just sort of the beauty of it, because you tend to, it's so easy to just sort of drift into abstractions,
right,
and generalities about, you know, a film being beautiful or whatever. And there's just something, again, if you can give it your first half hour and just say, all right, I'm still with it. I'm going to hang in there. You know, this doesn't seem to be going anywhere too quickly, but it's all about finding the film's rhythm yourself. And it is worth the search if you have to look for it.
Absolutely. Michael, what about some movies? Did you have any that just missed your list? Any honorable mentions?
Yeah, honestly, Moonrise Kingdom, very close. Arrietty, I think, The Secret World of Arrietty. Rampart, I liked a lot with Woody Harrelson. A film called In the Family, which a very small indie, very nice, very nice. The Marley documentary, I thought was really,
good film.
Really,
oh,
yeah, rich. Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of Josh and Adam. There's a lot of films on that level of kind of like really good, you know, somewhat surprisingly good genre pictures, like The Gray, which really was interesting and did have a little. I liked any film with any kind of pretension towards something more than just the usual action tropes. The Gray's worth seeing. Something like, you know, The Avengers was a little better than I expected, frankly. and you should jolly well see the Whit Stillman film, Adam, Damsels in Distress. Just to see,
I will do it.
Where you think of it?
First chance I get.
Yeah, I don't know. He's a guy who's almost as distinctive and stylized and arguably kind of narrow as a stylist as Wes Anderson, but his appeal is almost entirely verbal, not visual.
Exactly.
And
maybe that's why it's never completely worked for me.
Yeah.
In his previous films. So.
They're not easy revisits is what I find.
Hmm.
And I it was fun to go back to see Metropolitan again after almost a decade and a half since I'd seen it. But even these people that have rather narrow ranges, if they don't make too many movies, when they come around again and they find just enough variation in what interests them,
mm-hmm,
you think, yes, good. There they are again.
Yeah.
You know, they're back in it. Yeah.
Yeah. That film, Damsels in Distress, I forgot to look up when it comes out on DVD, but I will certainly be paying attention when it does. Josh, what about you, honorable mentions?
My honorable mentions, one was mentioned by a listener, Brave, and also in our poll was The Cabin in the Woods. I really, really enjoyed that film and thought about that for this list. The Kid with a Bike also, which we discussed on the show.
Yeah.
Could have easily made the list. I did catch up with a couple that didn't make the cut. Deep Blue Sea, I mentioned, still wrestling with. The Dictator, I managed to see. It's the most disappointing film of the year. The most disappointing for me. I'm a huge Sacha Baron Cohen fan. This thing is a disaster.
It's a dog, huh?
Wow.
Well, for me, you guys have mentioned most of them here. The Kid with the Bike was probably my number six. That was the hardest film to leave off from the Dardenne brothers. Arrietty, as I mentioned. I also considered a movie. I know, Michael, I read your review. You were not as taken with it as I was. You have something against Mark Duplass. It is Your Sister's Sister, a movie from Lynn Shelton. I really appreciate it. And this is not a film. Jafar Panahi's film.
Oh, that very close
is one
for me. Very
I thought
close
of. For me. And I'll cap this as you did, Josh. You mentioned the big disappointment. Earlier in the show, we talked about Magic Mike, Soderbergh's new movie, and Channing Tatum. For me, the single biggest surprise, it's not in my top 10, it's really probably not even in my top 15 of the year so far at this point, but close, is 21 Jump Street, a movie I never in a million years thought I would laugh at. And up until the third act, you talk about the final 15 or 20 minutes that doesn't pay off, and it gets really cliche and ham-fisted. But up until then, genuinely smart, genuinely funny. If people haven't checked it out, if you've been avoiding it because it's called 21 Jump Street, it's pretty funny. It's good.
It's in my queue.
Okay.
The first half is really funny.
Yeah.
And I guess that's enough for most people. And in this case, it was enough for me to recommend it.
Yeah. All right. Well, those are our top five films of 2012 so far. Send us your picks or any other feedback about the show. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting. And at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out wide this weekend, the new comedy from Seth MacFarlane, Ted, People Like Us, speaking of Mark Duplass, is in a supporting role in that movie. And Tyler Perry's Madea's Witness Protection.
It's that time of the month.
It is, indeed, apparently. Is that the tagline for that film?
I just think he makes a lot of movies.
He does make a lot of movies.
It's the time of month for too many apostrophes in a title.
No kidding. Yeah, exactly. And also Magic Mike, Steven Soderbergh's new film we discussed earlier in the show. Sounds like we're all three, to varying degrees, on board with this movie as a Soderbergh joint.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a joint.
Okay. Limited release, Take This Waltz. Again, we're going to talk about Sarah Polley's new film and our Film Spotting bonus content this week. You can get it through the Film Spotting apps. Woody Allen's new film, To Roam With Love, opens here in Chicago. And Grand Illusion, it's the 75th anniversary restored edition of the Jean Renoir classic. It's playing at the Gene Siskel Film Center this week.
Total piece of shit.
That was Michael Phillips.
I'm not buying that, Michael. Paul Williams, Still Alive, that documentary is out. And also The Invisible War. This sounds really interesting. I don't know, Michael, if you've seen it. Kirby Dick's documentary about rape within the U.S. military. Sounds harrowing, but sounds fascinating.
I'm actually watching that tomorrow on a DVD screener. So, yeah, I've heard it's very strong.
And also The Last Ride is opening here in Chicago in select cities. It takes place at the end of 1952. And Hank Williams is the main character, where it's kind of late in his career. And it sounds pretty interesting, though I don't really know anything more about it. It's called The Last Ride, opening here in Chicago. On Demand, a new film called A Burning Hot Summer, and 360, a film completely off my radar, but directed by Fernando Morales, who made City of God,
and then
less successfully, Blindness recently. It's got an amazing cast, if you don't know anything about this movie. It's starting this week on Demand. Next week on the show, we will get to our top five performances of 2012. So far, we're going to milk this halfway point all we can. And we're not really sure what we're going to talk about. We had hoped to talk about Spider-Man, which is opening next week for July 4th, but the screening schedule might not work out. We could talk about To Roam With Love, the Woody Allen film, if we get a chance to see it. Maybe do an overlooked DVD pick, or it could, in fact, be The Beast of the Southern Wild. So you'll just have to tune into Film Spotting next week to see what the surprise is.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was Kelly Hogan. Learn more at kellyhogan.com. Big thanks to you, Michael, for joining us, and where can listeners find you?
They can find me at chicagotribune.com/movies. And thanks for having me, guys.
It's always a blast to have you on, Michael. We'll look for you in a month or so, and then, of course, at the end of the year, you can school us with five or six more movies we haven't even heard of.
These are all gone. I've already ditched my
revising.
Nice. It wasn't commercial enough.
For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
I thought it was good. I loved it.
This was your post Annie face.
Here's seriously though. Shut up. Annie's great. Michael, Annie's great.
The film version sucks. What are you kidding?
Well, that's don't make him cry. I saw it when I was 8. Everything's
great. Wait till
when
we're
you're
done
8.
Recording, then make him cry.
Everything's great when you're 8.
Look, I saw Chitty Chitty Bang Bang when I was 8, and I hated it then. I mean, you know.
Well, you had a more refined palate at a younger age than I did.
Even if you think it's great when you're 8, though, you move on. And you have you not revisited it?
I'd love to watch it with my kids, and I think I
what
would
if they say
still
it's,
love it.
It's Carol terrible. Burnett, why are you making
Carol
watch
Burnett?
This?
She's fine. I mean,
she's great.
I don't think you're going to convince anyone.
Albert Finney, come on.